This interview is brought to you by Panasonic Lumix G cameras for today's photographer. Okay, I am here with Mr. Martin Evening. He's a photographer and an author, and you may have heard of him because he's written some pretty important books in the photography community. One of them that I'm staring at right now is called the Adobe Photoshop Lightroom 4 book. It's the complete guide for photographers, and he's written a companion book on that. I wouldn't even call it a companion book. It's another book called the Adobe Photoshop CS6. Is it 6, right,
Martin? Yes, that's the latest version.
Yeah. The Adobe Photoshop CS6. CS6 book for photographers as well. And both of these books, like I'm looking at the Lightroom book, and it weighs in around 700 pages. So this is the de facto guide to everything there is to know about Lightroom. Same thing on the Photoshop side. So Martin has agreed to come on and chat with us. You know how we do it on TWIP, just to talk about his beginnings as a photographer, and then we'll just transition into some of the books and what he wrote and why he wrote them. And if we're lucky, at the end, he'll throw in some tips that many of us may not have heard of about how to get the most out of these tools. So, Martin, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah, this is great. It's an honor. Now, you and I go back quite a ways, back to my Adobe days. I think that's when we first met. I think it was Lightroom 2 or 3. I forget which one.
I'm trying to remember now. I think it was either Lightroom, probably Lightroom 2, I think. Yes. It was around then, I think, when we first met up.
It was in that era, which feels like the Jurassic period right now, doesn't it?
Yeah, things move so quickly, that's for sure.
Absolutely. So we had a chance to chat and, interact on a business level. Now we get a chance to talk on more of a friend-to-friend level. So I'm looking forward to this conversation. Let's just kick it off with you and your history and why you are a photographer right now. Why, a lot of people have different reasons for wanting to be a photographer. What's yours?
I think probably the same as for a lot of people. It was one of those things where photography was a hobby of mine that I was really into. I think right from the age of 8 years old, when my father used to, was chatting to me once, picking me up from school, telling me about how he used to process negatives when he was living in Africa. And at that particular time, he had to get up at the crack of dawn to process his films because the chemicals would start boiling away if he did it any later. And of course, he needed the dark. And living where he was, he was able to process these negatives and make these contact prints, some of which I've still got around now. And it all just all sounded fantastic. All this sort of alchemy of developing and fixing pictures and seeing the results because they were there in the scrapbooks and the albums to see. So that got me fascinated, and I started underneath the stairs with my own darkroom, and then gradually out of that sort of grew a really sort of serious hobby. And then when the careers guidance officer came around asking what we wanted to do, I just said I wanted to be a photographer because I knew I wasn't really that academic, or I didn't think I was at that particular time. And photography just seemed like a really nice, fun thing to be doing. And so that's how I got started on that, going to college and then eventually working as an assistant in London. And the career sort of built up from there.
Yeah, that's great. And I've seen a lot of your work, and I'm looking at one of your sites now that has a lot of your work posted there. Just some amazing images from portraiture and fashion and that sort of thing. What drove you into that area?
Well, I would say it was actually probably a bit of an accident. It's one of those things where, fate, sort of directs you to take a particular course, and sometimes you just need to go with it. When I was at college, I was probably more interested in the idea of becoming an advertising photographer, for sure. I saw myself working in a studio, although I'd been really into photographing landscape a lot when I was at college as well. But I was trying to think of a career, and I wanted to be a commercial photographer. So I was actually looking around for full-time positions assisting still life photographers in London, and it just so happened I saw a fashion photographer who took me on trial and said, look, I've got a job coming up in the new year, if you want to come along and work with me, then I'm setting up a new studio. And really, he needed a dog's body, as we say over here, to actually do a lot of the work, just helping to build a studio, things like sanding a floor and building partition walls and stuff like that, which I was quite adept at doing. So I did a lot of kind of that sort of handiwork, but that led on to studio work once the studio was built, and a whole lot of experience working with fashion and hairstylists and stuff like that. And then I got really kind of hooked into it. I could see that, well, actually, I can see how this stuff works. I like you know, the whole sort of setup and the people I was working with. So that really sort of directed me in a way I never really sort of thought about before. And I'm pretty glad it did, because it's really given me a good career. I've enjoyed, you know, the career I've had so far, you know, working along those sort of lines. And it all sort of started from just a chance meeting all the way back, you know, in all those years ago.
Now, Martin, let's talk a little bit about that, because as you were talking, I just had this vision of you in the studio. You know, the sort of the vision that a lot of photographers have of these high-end fashion photographers in the studio. You're in London, mm-hmm. you've got the assistants buzzing around, you got the makeup artist and the stylist there, you have the client in the back room with a clipboard watching a display, and you're in the front directing things and making it all happen. What is that like? Yeah, I mean, what is it like to be that guy?
I think it's a sort of a You sort of kind of get into that. It's a learning process. I mean, I think when you do it initially, when you're younger, I mean, most of us who, you know, started off doing fashion and beauty probably started quite young. I started about 23 on my sort of solo career, and I don't think that was necessarily unusual. You know, still today you get people when they're quite young wanting to do it because it's a young person's business. And there's a certain degree of panic, I think, in youngsters once they start, like myself, once you start getting the big jobs, because then it suddenly becomes really serious with a lot of money involved. And I think that you do get the kind of what people might imagine, the sort of the archetypal fashion photographer kind of losing their cool and getting kind of very animated and over the top. And, you know, there are a lot of people, you know, you kind of tend to flounder a bit in the early years because you're trying to keep that image of being cool and looking like you're in, like you're in control, like a swan that looks like they're gracefully swimming along, yet you're paddling away frantically under the, you know, under the surface, just trying to keep things together because there's so many things that can go wrong. And over the years, you can become more adept and more skilled at being able to take on those shoots. That the stage I'm at the moment, I you have to have a certain amount of kind of adrenaline going, you know, every time you're doing a big shoot and there's a lot of money at stake. But I think that it becomes more second nature. So, you know all the things that can go wrong. You have a radar that kind of senses when stuff may be going awry and how to kind of sort of keep that under control. And you want to be mainly focused on doing what the client wants you to do, which is to be creative and to come up with, you know, a good solution to the brief. And I find it, it's hard work. I can kind of enjoy it. I don't really find it as sort of stressful or as I perhaps used to in the old days. It sort of seems more sort of kind of second nature, and so you can go with it, and you get this great satisfaction at the end of the day of doing a job where the client's happy and you've executed the brief well and you've given them what they wanted. It's a real good buzz, and I think that as long as you're feeling that, then you know you're doing well, because, you know, it's terrible to get to a stage where you become too complacent about the whole thing and take it all for granted. So I don't think any of that's been lost, you know, too much. It's still a really nice job to be doing, you know, compared to all the things that you could have been, you know, could have been doing, or even other types of, you know, commercial photography. So I look back and sort of think I've been really damn lucky and enjoyed every moment of it.
Yeah. Now, when looking at your work here, there's flawless images of course, you know, they've gone through your post processing and all that. But talk to me about that piece of it. When you've completed a shoot, you know, notwithstanding all the logistics and the planning and all that on the front end, but you've completed the shoot, you have the images, they're in Lightroom. You've literally written the book on Lightroom and Photoshop. So you know your way around the apps. Do you actually do the post-processing on your images? Or when you're on a job of that level with a high Fortune 500 or 100 client, do you have your assistants take over and do the retouching and post-processing and all that?
Well, I mean, when I'm working in the studio, I would use Lightroom usually to shoot tethered or do a card import, depending on which camera I was shooting with. But I mean, if I'm shooting with, say, a digital SLR like the Canon, I would shoot in tethered mode. And the beauty there is that you can, in Lightroom, you can set up preset settings, develop presets where you can create a certain type of look, which might just be as simple as just getting the exposure and the white clipping and black clipping, you know, sorted out, just so that the image that comes in is not just a flat raw, but like a nice punchy image that would appeal to the client. And then sometimes clients have got an end view in mind where they want a maybe slightly desaturated look, perhaps with a sort of slight hint of cross-processing coming in that you mentioned. And so you can tweak the settings a little bit to create a new develop preset that actually gives them kind of that final look. But of course, you're still shooting in raw mode, so that all the image information is still there. Mm-hmm. But it really works well with clients for them to actually sort of see the pictures coming through and pretty much as they would like to see them in the finished look. So that sort of is a real sort of bonus, and it doesn't take any longer to have the images processed and appear up that way on the screen. And then as in terms of what happens in the actual final post-production, I like to do all the retouching myself, but I still overall prefer not to sort of fiddle around too much. I mean, for sure, if you look on the website, I mean, I do cross-processing looks and things like that. But I mean, I'm in the work which I do in the studio as well as in the landscape work, I'm not really into sort of doing sort of tricksy sort of Photoshop stuff. And and that's probably emphasized in my books as well, because, you know, my books aren't really about the sort of kind of the clever tricks that you can do. They're more about looking at the viewpoint of a commercial photographer or maybe serious amateur and what they would like to do with their pictures, you know, if they're interested like me in doing sort of more sort of kind of straightforward photography, which is just tweaked and made to look nice in Photoshop or Lightroom, rather than getting into kind of, you know, the swapping overheads and, you know, kind of crazy sort of avant-garde sort of kind of stuff. I mean, I do that sometimes, but that's not really my main interest.
Now, how much time do you figure you spend per image? I know it is subjective and variable, but generally.
Yeah, I pretty much work it out as 40 minutes, you know, usually. You know, if I'm sort of, you know, when you're sort of costing up, you know, for a job, you need to include retouching time as well. So, you know, usually a minimum of about sort of 40 minutes would be spent on an image. You know, sometimes it goes over, but I mean, I can then sort of carefully calculate how much of my time is billable, and that usually works out pretty well. Then if clients want to do any extras beyond that, you know, then I would allow extra for it. And if it's an advertising job, then probably I find about 2 to 3 hours. I would, you know, so usually put billing in. Oh, so I would do an estimate for about sort of 2 to 3 hours work per image, knowing that it's slightly different because there with an advertising brief, there's usually more, you know, there's more kind of back and forth on a particular job. And usually working with art buyers, you know, they're pretty much okay with that as an initial sort of quotation and know that if they do start asking for more, then, you know, you can keep on sort of clocking up more hours, you know, as necessary.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about gear a little bit, or just workflow in general. When you're doing fashion, of course, it's different than you're doing, you know, when you're shooting other kinds or other genres of photography. But speaking specifically about your fashion work, what's in your bag when you go out to a shoot and you do one of these typical shots, like on the shots, the headshots and 3/4 shots I'm looking at on your site? Mm-hmm. What do you take with you, and what lighting are you using? What does it look like?
Well, the lighting I use will be almost, you know, it's kind of like whatever's, you know, there. I think with the, you know, the flash lighting, as somebody said, as long as it goes pop, you know, then it's okay.
You know,
I use Dellenchrome quite a bit, but I use Profoto at the studio. So I don't know if you have that in the US, but I mean, Profoto's lights are pretty, you know, pretty nice. But I'm quite a fan of using the monoblocks because they're quite sort of easy and light to carry around, and I don't need to use such high power. I tend not to want to go and sort of shoot at the smallest f-stop, you know, necessarily. So for the fashion work, you know, usually the monoblocks can work really well. And then in terms of the camera, I also use sometimes just natural lighting. You know, it's quite nice to use that, or to use HMI lighting, or maybe tungsten lighting, balance that in with the daylight. Mm. So I'm kind of interested in different sort of lighting sources. But in terms of equipment, I've mostly been using Canon digital SLRs, so I'm still using the EOS 1DS Mark III at the moment. I've not been completely sold on the idea that the 1DX is, you know, necessarily something I want to get. If I was buying afresh right now, I'd be probably quite tempted by the Nikon D800 or D800E. I think that's a pretty much a landmark camera, I think, in digital SLR technology right now.
Yeah.
And then I've also used the Hasselblad sometimes, the Hasselblad HD40 or 50. And those have been pretty good, really good in the studio, the quality you get from that. In fact, I think the book that you mentioned, the Lightroom 4 book, the cover shot of that was photographed using the Hasselblad HD4 with the, I think the 50 megapixel back, I think, on that occasion. And I've taken it on location as well. I've borrowed one out on location and used that. I think still on balance, I'm still more a fan of the digital SLRs. I think that the quality that you can get from the very latest digital SLRs is pretty amazing, especially the Nikon one I mentioned. I mean, you know, you've got almost as many megapixels as the Hasselblad I just discussed. Mm-hmm. And yeah, as long as you're using good quality lenses, I mean, you know, you've got the versatility there of being able to shoot in the studio and with really good ISO performance, which I think generally for some of the medium format bags, that's not necessarily the case. Better be careful, because I think that some of them, looking at the DX or Optics website, which gives you a comparison of some of the cameras, I've seen some of the medium format cameras that are out now, they have actually got good ISO performance at high ISO settings. But generally, I found that the digital SLRs are far more versatile. So, you know, you can use them for a lot more things than you can necessarily with a medium format camera. Yeah. But then interestingly, I've also just recently just got hold of a Sony RX100 camera, one of these little, you know, digital, you know, compact system cameras.
Yeah.
And it's pretty inexpensive, but I've been amazed at the quality you get. It's about 20 megapixels, and, you know, a lot of photographers have been reviewing them, saying it's like a good alternative camera to shooting with a digital SLR, and so it's something you can easily carry in your pocket all the time. So I've only just started shooting with it, but what I've seen so far from the results I got from the files is pretty amazing. Shooting in RAW mode, obviously.
Now, is that a Micro Four Thirds camera? Is it full frame? What's the sensor size?
It's a 1-inch sensor size, okay. So it's kind of sort of somewhere in between there. It's, you know, between that and a, you know, say the smaller sensors that you get on the small you know, digital compact cameras, sorry, digital SLR cameras. So it's it's a slightly bigger sensor than you get in some of the other compact system cameras. So you can already see in the pictures I've shot, you know, that you get a bit of depth of focus in there, effect, you know, where you get a sort of shallow focus shooting at the f/1.8 aperture. The optics is really good looking at the center, not so great towards the edges of the frame, I don't think, but really, really impressed actually with the quality with that. So it's a nice alternative to shoot with when I don't want to carry around a big camera.
But is it that a camera that you would consider using on a commercial job?
It depends, I suppose. Not in a studio shoot, no. I think, yeah, no, I wouldn't see myself sort of shooting sort of the fashion stuff with it. But I mean, if you're doing a portrait assignment, maybe sometimes it could be quite sort of handy to have for some occasions. I don't know. I'd have to sort of see. It's, you know, these cameras, they're a little bit slow to work with sometimes. You know, the beauty of using a digital SLR is you've got fast shooting capability. You can quick shoot bursts of shots. So I'd probably find it a bit limiting, I think, for shooting the commercial stuff that I do. But certainly for any situation where you kind of regret not having a camera on you, you know, there's no excuse now. I can always carry this around with me in my pocket or in the bag.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Now, what about your iPhone? Or do you have an iPhone? Or do you shoot? Do you shoot with that at all?
I do, and yeah, the pictures are what you pretty much expect. I mean, they're pretty good, aren't they? You know, but I'm always pretty disappointed in the results that come from an iPhone picture. I think actually in my book, there's a picture I did of a beautiful sunset, you know, with one of those fantastic sort of semisphere, you know, complete rainbows. Mm-hmm. And that was a stitch shot, which I did, shot from a bridge in London, where we were just driving back from, you know, from somewhere, and it just was this fantastic rainbow. And I didn't have a camera with me, and I just had the iPhone, so I shot that. And it looked pretty nice by the time I stitched the shots together, and I used that in my book. And I think there's maybe one other picture I might have shot with the iPhone of my daughter that might have been in the book. But other than that, I mean, I've shot a lot of pictures with it, but there's nothing I've ever really considered that would be good enough to use. I'm not really got into Instagram and all that sort of kind of thing. I sort of find that if I'm going to sort of take pictures, I would rather use a camera I feel that's going to be worth working with to get something good out. And I'd rather be kind of sort of like quite serious about the editing process to get down just to the pictures that I really want to show. Yeah. So, yeah, it's nice that you can use it, but it's just really more for fun, I think.
So, Martin, let's talk a little bit about your just sort of your movement in the different genres of photography. So my exposure to you is when in your beauty and fashion work. And mm-hmm. and now through the exchange of the emails that we did, you were telling me that you're starting to do a lot more landscape. You want to give me an idea of why you're moving in that direction?
I think it's probably partly a sort of career change that's taking place. You know, I started writing books about Photoshop. Let me see, about 96, I think, was when I first started work on my first book. So, you know, I've been doing it for quite a while and using Photoshop for quite a while as well. So that, you know, that at that particular time, I was more interested in Photoshop, obviously, for what I could do with it in my work, in my work sphere. So I was using it to retouch my pictures and, you know, and really becoming quite sort of experienced as a photo retoucher as a result of all that work. And then the writing was like a side thing, which kind of took off. So by the time I think we met, I was probably really busy sort of shooting probably 2 or 3 days a week. You know, there was an intense schedule and I had to work really hard to kind of juggle around working with various assistants, helping me out on shoots and castings and stuff like that to fit all that in with writing the books, which usually took place in the evenings. And I was getting pretty burnt out at times, you know, doing all that sort of work. But then it was a really good thing because, you know, working as a photographer, as a commercial photographer, and then writing the books, you know, I had the viewpoint of somebody who was doing this stuff really for a living rather than, you know, coming at it as somebody who was a writer first who happened to take good pictures. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, you know, with the, you know, partly to do with the economy, I suppose, there's less, you know, there's been less commissions coming through, partly because I am getting older. And I think mainly because of all that, you know, I really wanted to concentrate on the books. The books have become bigger and bigger. You know, they've taken up more and more of my time. So I've ended up putting all my focus really onto that. So I don't really shoot so much commercially now, which I don't mind. I mean, I've really enjoyed, you know, the work which I've done, and it's been a great career. But it's kind of interesting to go back more to my roots, where I'm more taking photographs of landscapes and really enjoying that and getting a passion, you know, building for that as my photography, you know, work, which I do. And then, you know, I've got a whole archive of pictures that I can call upon that I shot in the past, portraits I did and stuff. And then every now and then, you know, I still shoot pictures deliberately, you know, specifically for the books. So there's a nice sort of mixture of work going on there. I wouldn't really want to be kind of diluting myself too much. So I feel like I need to really concentrate on the writing more now.
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, it's all photography, right? So you're just taking, or you're exposing different kinds of pixels in this with your landscape work. You know, there at least a couple of years ago there was this resurgence of or some would say an insurgence of HDR, yeah, you know, yeah, and that kind of photography. Where do you fall on that? You know, are you an HDR shooter?
Yes, I am. Yeah, I shoot a lot of stuff. If I see something which has got a, you know, a tricky dynamic range, you know, that I'm shooting, I will always bracket. So I've done that for quite a while and collected a lot of those sort of shots together. I've never been completely happy with the HDR processing though. That's always been a problem. So the, you know, there's been all this material I've been working with, and I've been disappointed with what I've been getting out of it, and it's hard to kind of avoid those ugly halos. Mm-hmm. So I've been I was very intrigued by it to start off with. I mean, I got sort of bitten by the bug initially to try and create that look, and I think within about two photos I just gave up on it. I just thought, this is horrible. So I've you know, I've been pretty much anti the HDR look, you know, that kind of thing. And it's interesting, when I judged a landscape competition a couple of years ago, that out of the hundreds and hundreds of photographs that were sent through from the preliminary round and the second judging that we were doing, there were no HDR or obvious HDR images left in the pot. They all got culled by the wayside. And it wasn't just me, you know, there's a lot of us judging, and we all made the same decision quite independently that we didn't like that. And so, but that doesn't mean to say that the pictures that ended up in the final selection weren't HDR shots, because you can process HDR captured images, you know, really nicely. And it's interesting you mentioned that, because what's happened more recently is, you might be aware, with Camera Raw 7.1 and Lightroom 4.1, the opportunities there now to take bracketed exposures to create a 32-bit master file, save it as a TIFF, and then process it in, say, Lightroom or Camera Raw, but I mainly do this in Lightroom. You can then process using the latest Process 2012 to actually process a 32-bit image just as you would process a regular RAW.
Wow.
So what's happened now, this is interesting, especially over the last month or so. I've been going through a lot of photographs I shot from, say, a couple of years ago when I was touring around the Southwest and in America. And I shot a lot of HDR stuff, you know, a lot of bracketed exposures. I've been now actually processing those pictures, whereas previously I was just losing interest because I didn't like the obvious results that I was getting. I'm now creating master 32-bit TIFFs and then just having them pop up in Lightroom and then straight away just editing them as if they were RAWs. And what's interesting is that if you do push the sliders too much, you can get to see some halos coming in, but generally you don't. And so I've been getting some very nice tame results that don't really look too different from regular RAW photos. There's a whole lot more of stuff I can now go through. So I've got a mission at the moment to get into that, well, that HDR stuff that I thought was kind of becoming a bit of a waste of time.
Now, is that technique or, you know, just sort of running through that process going to be included in your next book?
I'm trying to remember. I did do some videos. I think I recorded some videos. Yeah, I did for the Photoshop for Photographers website.
Good.
Some stuff up there. I can't remember if that's just done specifically for the readers of the book. You know, if you buy the book, you can get access to the website to get extra content. So I think that might just be on there. I can't remember if I made it publicly accessible or not. So don't quote me on that. I'd have to go and check the website to see. I know I did that for the Lightroom book website. So that is just accessible for people who register the book. So at least for people who bought the book, they haven't been let down. They can still access and see these latest techniques. And there's probably a whole lot of other material information out there on the internet that people can access anyway. But it's very straightforward. Just basically do what you did before. Just get 3 or 5 images that have been bracketed, run them through either Photomatics Pro or through Merge to HDR Pro in Photoshop to create the 32-bit file, and then don't do anything else with them. Don't manipulate them in any way. Just save it as a regular 32-bit TIFF file, and then you can open it in Camera Raw or in Lightroom, and then process using the latest process 2012 just as if it was a regular image. That you don't do anything different, except you just have more dynamic range to play with.
That's great. Oh, I'll be playing with that after this interview.
Oh, I highly recommend it. Yeah. You'll be impressed, I promise you.
So Martin, let's talk a little bit about books. So before we continue, just to give those URLs out really quickly to people that may have missed them. So photoshop4photographers.com is the companion site for the Photoshop CS6 book, right?
That is, yeah. And you can, if you've got older versions of the book, you can click from there to go and see the websites for the previous versions as well. But yeah, that'll be for the most recent one. And there are some sample movies on there that people can access. I think also if you go to YouTube and you do a search for the Photoshop book or a search for my name, they have actually released all the videos there as well. So you can actually see all the video, you know, content. There's a whole host of videos they can get there for free. And then with the other URL, which is the lightroombook.com, that one takes you through to a Peachbit website where you have to register to say you got the book, and then you can access all the content or the movie content that's supplied, including those videos I just mentioned. So those are provided there for readers. I think there's content that you can get without registering as well, but certainly on the Photoshop for Photographers website there's free stuff there, and YouTube as well, you know, a lot of you know, free to access movies.
Well, let's talk about just briefly about the you know, the world of print publishing versus ebook and iBook publishing. Now, you know, looking at this book, it's a hefty book, and I understand why, you know, because I don't see how a book like this could easily translate into a digital format. But have you considered moving in that direction and adding interactivity into a book that people can throw on their iPads or on their Android device?
Yeah, it would be good to do that. I mean, there are ebook versions of these books that are produced. And if I can talk frankly here, I've not really wanted to encourage them too much. I mean, I know that there are readers who demand and like those formats. And of course, you know, ebook formats work really well for, you know, many types of books. I haven't done enough research on this to sort of check out what the latest books are looking like. When I last was looking at other software titles as ebooks, you know, my impression is that when you take a really nicely designed print book format and try and, you know, produce that in an ebook format, especially with this requirement to sometimes dumb down to the, you know, to the Kindle, you know, format. Mm-hmm. I just don't think it really works, you know, that well. What I have seen that has worked really well has been done by colleagues of mine, like Philip Andrews, where he's been working specifically on a book designed for the iPad or for a large tablet device. And there it works really well. I mean, I think that if you're doing something for the tablet, you know, and I think it's only really got to be for the tablet, forget doing, you know, for these little hand readers, you know, it's just a waste of time. But for something like that, a proper color device, I think that, you know, there's a big future in that. I don't know how well Philip has been able to make it work for him, but I can certainly see a lot of potential in it. And so I think that it probably calls for like a fresh approach to do something specifically for that format. And then the other thing to get around is e-publishing rules or book publishing rules, where at the moment, I think if you're doing a e-book as a version of a print book, because you can't really change anything that's in the print book when they do an update to the program, like, you know, we just mentioned the 4.1 update for Lightroom, where you can then do this, you know, photo with it, do this HDR stuff. It's a tricky area because you can't update the print book, so therefore you're not officially allowed to update the ebook. Although, yeah, if it should be feasible, it should be really easy to do. So if you're supplying an ebook kind of thing through a different channel that doesn't have that sort of that restriction, that's, you know, or that rule placed upon you, then, you know, the neat thing should be that you should be able to then update those books so that people can subscribe and get updates, just like you do with apps. You know, you get an app update that allows you to get the latest version with all the modifications. So there is potential to do that, but the whole publishing thing at the moment, I think, with ebooks as version of print books, is kind of sort of tricky to give ebook purchasers really what they want, because, you know, the potential's there to do something really good. I haven't really got much into that, and one of the reasons is that, you know, the print books sell really well. Yeah. I know that's not the same in the publishing industry generally, but, you know, as far as things go at the moment, what I do producing print books sells certainly well enough to justify continue doing the same. It doesn't mean it's going to be like that forever, but for the time being, there doesn't seem to be any good reason to really break away from that format whilst there's a huge demand for it.
Right. If it's not broke, don't fix it, right?
Yeah, but keep an eye on the future. Never allow, you know, yourself to stand still or you know, never say never. I mean, you know, you've always got to keep an open mind about these things.
Now, speaking of keeping an eye on the future, you've just moved, right? You've just relocated and bought a beautiful new piece of land, and you're about to build a brand new Martin Evening Lair out there.
Yes, we bought this house. I mean, you know, we bought it from this elderly couple, and, you know, it was quite nice actually being able to go along there for the first time, having exchanged the day, to be able to see the house, you know, as it is, without having to do all the small talk and stuff. And it's quite funny because we were there for about half an hour, and suddenly who should we see? The old couple came tottering up the road. They came back, and so, you know, it kind of spoiled the moment. We had to go and sort of do small talk again and stuff like that. I mean, what we really want to do is measure things up and stuff. But yeah, no, it's an old house that is an acre plot of land on the edge of a natural forest, and so our plan is to knock it down and do a rebuild and build this house of the future. That's the idea, but I mean, whether we can get planning permission or not to do that, we'll have to go and see.
That's great. Now, will you have an area for a studio, or is this strictly living space only?
It's both. Yeah, I mean, it'll be, maybe if I'm lucky, I'll be able to go and get a small little shooting space down in the basement. That would be kind of cool. But it's mainly going to be a living area. I don't need too much space to be able to work. I just need somewhere to go and put my computers and my toys and things like that, and have a little office to be able to work from. And that will be great. So having seen the designs that the architects come up with so far, it's pretty exciting.
Wow, that's great. I'm looking forward to that. So when do you break ground, and when do you estimate completion?
Well, I mean, if we're lucky, we could do something late spring next year, but these things can sometimes drag on for years. So I don't want to be precipitous by trying to sort of guess that we're going to get planning permission through. I don't think it's necessarily going to be that easy. So we'll have to go and see what can happen.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Martin, I want to be respectful of your time. I know you, this being the day that you got the keys to the house, I'm sure you have a couple of things to take care of.
So like painting and decorating and all sorts of stuff like that.
Yeah. Like maybe making the beds up so you can actually have some place to sleep and all that. But let's leave the listeners with one tip. If you could give us one, since you are the guy that literally wrote the book on Lightroom, give us one of those sort of deep down DNA level tips that photographers may not have known about, especially if they're just scratching the surface of the software. What would you tell them to do?
Oh, it's really hard to say because, I mean, my sort of head sort of starts reeling about all the different things that you can actually do in Lightroom and why it's, useful. I mean, I do advocate people consider importing everything into one catalog. I think that's pretty, there's all the consistent advice out there that says that is probably the most effective way to work rather than trying to split up your personal work from your, from your commercial, work. There's very good ways of being able to filter that. And I think that not to kind of dismiss the power of the metadata and what you can actually do with that, how you can actually make use of the metadata that's already, going to be embedded in your files and how that can help you in searching for your pictures. But the value metadata that you can add yourself, and not to be too discouraged by talk of the need to put in dozens of keywords on every single image that you put in. I think sometimes even you just put in one or two keywords on everything as you're importing and get into the habit of doing that as a regular discipline when you're importing your photos, it will pay rewards, for you later, because it's going to make it so much easier for you to handle being able to search for those images. Because, at the moment, I don't know what I'm up to. I'm probably about 140,000 images in my Lightroom catalog at the moment. And there are people I know who've got a lot more pictures, than that. And I think everybody's going to find that their catalogs are going to grow and grow and grow all the time. And so, think about the future and where you're going to be going. The rate at which we're taking pictures right now, just be aware that you're going to have a huge number of photographs that just aren't going to get any less, the more work you can put in at the moment to get into the routine of doing that, it's going to pay dividends in the future.
Now, just to piggyback on that a little bit, the whole idea of one catalog, how does that affect performance? Because a lot of people say, well, if I put all my images in one catalog, then Lightroom will slow to a crawl, and which is why I need to split them out into separate catalogs. Is that thing gone now? Is that whole problem gone?
I wouldn't say that the whole sort of catalog issue and the speed and issues and Lightroom have been, resolved. I think that is still, I would say that's probably still ongoing, that people are always going to want things to be faster. But then if you start splitting things up into different catalogs, aren't you sort of surely making sort of life harder or slower for yourself if that means that you then have to start, reloading different catalogs or trying to remember which catalog it is you've got to load up in order to find the images that you want, whereas maybe by having a lot of images in there, it's going to slow things up to some extent because, there's more to search through. But, compared to other methods of searching like, Bridge, which, is not Bridge's strength, trying to use it as a cataloging program, you can try to, but, it takes forever to try and search through the metadata on that. There are admittedly other programs I think that perhaps got good reputations in that regard in terms of the speed with which their cataloging functions work, but I don't necessarily think I found it's really sort of slowed me up that much that I've ever regretted taking the decision to put everything into one. I think it works very effectively for me.
Great. All right. Well, that's sage advice. Well, Martin, I will leave it at that. Once again, listeners, if you want to check out Martin or check out the books that we're talking about, the Photoshop book is at photoshopforphotographers.com and the Lightroom book is at thelightroombook.com. Martin, thank you once again. Congratulations on the house and best of luck in 2013, man.
Okay. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Always.